Make sure you never miss an episode of Post Show Recaps. Go to postshowrecaps.com/iTunes to subscribe, or search for Post Show Recaps on your favorite podcast app.
Spider-Man Homecoming is over, but we're just getting started talking about it here on Post-Show Recaps, a very special episode of Post-Show Recaps. One of the rare movie recaps has been spotted in the wild. It is swinging your way into your podcast feed. I am Josh Wigler, and I am joined here by the guy in the chair, your friendly neighborhood, Antonio Mazzaro. Antonio, how's it going?
This is great. A wild movie podcast appears. Josh uses movie podcasts, and hopefully it's super effective. This will be great.
I hope so. I hope it's super effective. And a Marvel podcast to boot without Kevin Mahadeo. Usually he's the guy here. Some news on that front coming up in the next few weeks.
Oh, yeah. Perhaps we will have some kind of defense of what's going on. Yeah, no Kevin Mahadeo. I hope to step into his Spidey suit. We'll see if I can pull this off.
Yeah, so let's see if you can pull this off. Pull off the mask, perhaps, but do that only around people who you trust.
Yeah, mask off. That's something to think about for the future, for sure.
Mask off, dance off. All right, so we are dancing into your podcast feed with some Spider-Man podcasting. Unless you live under a rock or under a ton of concrete, as it were, you have heard that there is a Spider-Man movie that has just arrived. It's kind of like, wait, wasn't there a Spider-Man movie like 2 years ago starring a completely different person? Yeah, basically, that's the case as well, but we are doing the reboot thing once again here with Spider-Man, although a little bit differently this time in that Spider-Man now exists in the world-famous Marvel Cinematic Universe. This is a Spider-Man movie that is set in the same universe as Iron Man and Captain America and all that good stuff. So kind of a momentous occasion and definitely something that Antonio and I wanted to podcast about, even if only for a little bit.
Yeah, we got this, even if you weren't following the news about all of the corporate structuring and Sony having rights to this and connecting that, you should have seen, if you watched Captain America Civil War, and a spoiler alert for that film, you would have seen Spider-Man in that movie. And you would have understood that this is the beginning of a new era for the MCU with regard to working Spider-Man into the story. And Spider-Man appearing in that movie was the beginning of this new character, Spider-Man, played by Tom Holland, not by Andrew Garfield, as you were alluding to earlier. He was replaced. Andrew Garfield, is he familiar with being kicked off of a project that he was part of? Is that something he's done in previous movies? Perhaps he needs a better social network, Josh.
Maybe needs a better social network. This is a shame. I really did like Andrew Garfield as Peter Parker, though. It was a very dour Spider-Man that we got. It was a very somber, emo Spider-Man. Like, if you thought that the emo Tobey Maguire dancing around as the Venom symbiote Spider-Man in Spider-Man 3 was emo, I do think that Andrew Garfield kicked that up a few notches. But I like the actor. I was really bummed that his vision, Mark Webb's vision of Spider-Man got dropped after only two movies, but it wasn't really trending in a great direction to begin with, I think, and certainly if the consequence of that is we get Spider-Man Homecoming, I am willing to pay that blood sacrifice every day of the week.
Yeah, and Homecoming, an interesting title, considering it's now a Marvel Studios co-production with Sony, and that there is this homecoming of the character into the MCU. There's a lot going on, obviously. We'll talk about the other significant parts of that film title as we get into more spoiler areas of this particular movie. But yeah, this is it's great to see Spider-Man situated in the MCU because it is such a rich universe that has already built so much. It provides a great opportunity for Spider-Man to play a role in this existing ongoing conflict on many different levels. And so that's fascinating to watch how it's going to be introduced in this film, which we'll talk about, and then talk about what we think might happen for the future. So it's really a cool homecoming for this character, and I'm glad Spidey is situated within the MCU at this point.
Okay, so as we're going to talk through this movie, we are going to get into deep spoiler territory after not too long here on the podcast. We'll start off with just some spoiler-free thoughts about the movie in case you haven't seen it yet, so you still have maybe a minute or two, maybe 5 minutes. We'll see how long this part goes to get out of here if you haven't seen the movie and you're accidentally about to wander into some spoilers. So just be careful. It's very webby in here. We've got taser webs. We've got concussive webs. We've got all sorts of webs going on here. Podcast webs, Antonio, the worldwide webs.
Yeah, we're at Web Grenades. We're good. But yeah, we'll put it in the show notes, a timestamp when the spoiler section starts. We're just going to loosely talk about the film in very broad, non-spoiler terms for just a minute or two here before we delve fully into it.
Yeah, so, well, let's start there. I mean, I don't really know what your history as a Spider-Man fan is to begin with, Antonio, and what your history is with the Spider-Man movies. I know you were a great appreciator of Spider-Man 2, the second Tobey Maguire and Sam Raimi collaboration, but give me your thoughts on getting through Homecoming and seeing this movie, and what did it mean to you? And I think that you and I are both on the same page that this was really tons of fun.
Yeah, really, really fun. Actually, a perfect summer movie, I think, and one is going that's going to make a ton of money because it services so many different audiences in so many different ways.
Yeah,
there's just no doubt in my mind. People are going to want to see this movie multiple times. It's going to play well with kids and adults. It's a true feat in that regard that it was able to accomplish so much for so many different people, especially with a film with a background like Spider-Man, which is it's a pretty well-tread story, as we're talking about, and with a film that had so many different writers and was really an interesting project in terms of its development. I think it was a fantastic product that was developed or produced at the end of that, and I think it is well-deserved any success that it has. For me, I'm not a guy who comes into Spider-Man married to the source material. I was a DC Comics guy in terms of reading a lot of Batman comics and really liking that universe and those villains and those things. I was never really a Marvel guy, comics-wise. So my Marvel love has come almost exclusively from their movies and from the things that they've done in terms of other media, TV shows and whatnot. So I don't have the crosses to bear that it seems like many comics fans do, especially when it comes to Spider-Man, where you've got him not using web shooters or using them and offending half the audience one way or the other. You've got him being emo or not being emo. You've got him doing one thing or doing another. Like, it just seems like this is always a very, very difficult job in terms of pleasing the fans of what is no doubt beloved source material, because Spider-Man is kind of a normal dude. He's a kid. He's not Tony Stark. He's a kid who's smart and had a bad thing happen to him and is otherwise a normal guy with these powers foisted upon him. So I think a lot of people really associate with Spider-Man. It seems like there's a lot of beloved material, and it seems like when previous Spider-Man projects have let people down, it seems like it's because of that. It seems like it's because of expectations. So it's been a lot easier for me, because I don't have any desire for the source material, to watch a movie like Spider-Man 2 and just be blown away. I said at the time, and I've said this recently looking back, I remember driving home from Spider-Man 2 and thinking, oh my God, like, superhero movies can actually be really, really good. Like, I thought they could be entertaining or fun or just action movies, but this one is like a great drama. Like, I really...
You hadn't seen Batman and Robin yet?
I hadn't seen Batman and Robin yet. No, I certainly had not seen Batman. Yes, of course I had seen Batman and Robin. That's the point, right? That's the point. I'd seen Superman 3, which is fun and funny.
And then you walked into the Spider-Man movies. It's like, why aren't there nipples on the spider suit? Where are those things?
Where are the cod pieces? Like, what's going on here? Where are the absolutely ridiculously cartoonish villains? Like, where's Danny DeVito? What's happening? Although I like Batman Returns. But I thought this was actually a great movie. I remember thinking, wow, there's a lot of heft in this script. Like, and of course, Spider-Man 3 was pretty garbage in my opinion. So I'm not going to just bow at the altar of that trilogy and say it was the be all end all. But I really, really thought, I mean, Ebert said at the time, Roger Ebert, who is since deceased, said at the time that he thought Spider-Man 2 was the best superhero film ever made. And that's certainly what I walked away from Spider-Man 2 thinking. And in the time since, I've not really felt like there's been another home run in the Spider-Man universe. And I think that's frustrating for a lot of people who are fans of the character. And I think it's really great, at least for me, that this is for certain a home run.
So a homecoming run. Yes. Yeah, I think that there's a lot to pick apart there. I think the continuity one is something that resonates with me. I'm more of a Marvel guy than a DC guy by a lot. I love the Marvel characters, but I don't really come to Marvel, you know, through the comic books necessarily. I certainly read a bunch when I was a kid, but not feverishly. I was more into the cartoons, the few movies that we did get. So the MCU has really been my biggest Marvel touchstone. You know, it's certainly with a lot of characters that I recognized and like action figures that I played with when I was a kid and the few comics that I did read and a lot of the cartoons that I did watch. And this has really been the continuity that I've been the most steeped in as far as Marvel is concerned. But there's been tons of versions of Spider-Man with that being said. Like, you know, there was like the live action 1970s TV show. There's the 60s cartoon. There's the 90s cartoon. There's all of the stuff with Ultimate Spider-Man and Miles Morales, and there's some interesting things to talk about there on this podcast as well. I think that there are all these different versions of Spidey, and, you know, you've got like an adult Peter Parker in the current Marvel comics. Sometimes he's married, sometimes the devil takes that away. You know, there's just all sorts of different versions of this character, and so I think what's important to bear in mind as you're entering Spider-Man Homecoming is this is the Marvel Cinematic Universe's version of Spider-Man. It's very much inspired, I believe, by early days of Spider-Man, by the original comics, and how that Peter Parker was a kid who would have to worry about homework, who would have to worry about his high school obligations, would have to be in bed before, you know, a certain hour that Aunt May has established. And that's really the version of Spider-Man you're getting in this movie as well. And that's really just a fun version of this character to get in my mind, that this is really, you know, Tobey Maguire's what, like 27 when that first Spider-Man movie comes out, and he's playing, you know, a junior in high school, and it's, you know, a little far-fetched. It really is that kind of thing where it's like you're casting, I don't know, what's a good example of like a young adult who's being cast to play a kid? I guess Tobey Maguire as that version of Peter Parker is sort of the quintessential example, and Tom Holland, who's in his early 20s, is playing 15 in this movie, and he feels the part. Like, he has a youthful enthusiasm, he has a youthful look to it, and the surrounding cast is really in that vein as well. So in much the way that, you know, Spider-Man 2 opened your eyes, Antonio, that superhero movies could be a certain way, I do think that Spider-Man Homecoming is actually a little bit of a genre breaker in its own way, in that this really is the first true high school superhero movie that I can think of, or it's certainly the best by far, and I really am struggling to think of like what's another even peer in this category. And I think that this is going to hit really, really well with young kids. If you're a parent listening to this podcast, your kids, I think, are going to love this movie. There's some moments of darkness and intense action for sure, but it is all underscored by a lot of levity, a lot of lightness, and just fun and whimsy. And in that regard, that's my favorite version of Spider-Man, whenever you can get him in that way. And I think that Homecoming does a killer job with that. And it's a really fun extension of the Marvel Cinematic Universe as well, if you've been really enjoying these movies.
Yeah, and as we talked about, not only the continuity, but situating Spider-Man within that continuity in Captain America: Civil War, when you're introduced to this version of Spider-Man, that's what he brings to the screen almost instantly, is that attitude, is that Spider-Man. I think a lot of people that probably have complaints about the Sam Raimi Spider-Man didn't like the fact that you don't have this brash little, not little, but just a guy who's running his mouth and talking and just having this character, this attitude where it's upbeat. And he's in the moment in all that he's doing, that if you take the and you lean into the darkness, you take that away from Spider-Man. He's not Deadpool. I mean, he's not breaking the fourth wall in that way and really just completely like the Merc with a mouth kind of thing. But he is a guy who I think is known for this sort of levity and the sort of things that Tom Holland instantly brought to the character when he debuted in Civil War. So to see that in this film expanded in a way that is genre bending, as you're pointing out, it isn't just that you have a teenage superhero. We see that in young adult fiction and these movies like that, where kids are granted powers or they do these things, or we see young adult type superheroes. This is I know that this is a comparison that's made all the time, but this is like a John Hughes style high school movie about all the things that are prevalent in high school: classes and detentions and teachers and board teachers and love interest and dances and cliques and things like that. And it really it takes that and situates it within the Spider-Man universe. So you've got his typical rivals. You've got the typical people that play a part in his story. But you also have him at age 15 playing a 15-year-old. And I think that that's great. We laugh because we joke about it. I know this is something that you experienced, Josh, the musical Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
Yes. I saw both versions.
You saw both versions.
I saw the Broadway show.
You saw someone
show.
Die, right?
I saw the Broadway show when it was in rehearsals, and they were shutting the production down like midway through. And, you know, they're like, yeah, we got to work on this thing. Just hang tight. We'll be back in 10 minutes. And man, was that like a 3 out of 100 is what I used to call it. And then I saw the second version of the play, and you know, it was much improved. Like, the arc of improvement was really dramatic. Like, they got it all the way to like a 63 out of 100. So I mean, like, still a failing grade, but massive quality leap for sure. That's just an aside, neither here nor there.
No, I brought it up because I knew you had those funny stories, but also because I feel like what this film does with the context of the Spider-Man universe is it does to an extent turn off the dark. It leans into the light. It leans into the levity. It leans into the power. But it also has this really cool connection to the MCU, which we'll talk about. And it situates that in such a way that there are consequences. And it does really, in a non-dark way, tell a story that has a lot of value. So I'm really excited to break it down from a spoiler perspective with you and to get into all that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really key is that this is a movie that is, as much as it is a Spider-Man movie, it is a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie, and we are now, I think that this is the 16th movie in the MCU at this point, unless my math is off on that. That's a lot, and I remember vividly the days of, like, Iron Man being the first, you know, and just hearing Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury say the words Avengers Initiative, like, were just, like, the most exciting things, and your mind was just racing with possibility, and now we're here. And I was an adult, you know, when those movies were starting. I can't even imagine what it's been like to be a young kid growing up with the MCU as your major blockbusters. A very different experience from the types of movies that you were seeing as a kid, Antonio, or I was seeing as a kid. But still, I think that the Marvel Studios blockbusters, as far as like big budget action movies go, I have said this before and I will keep saying it, I don't think they can be beat right now. I think that they are the top of the line. Not hit, you know, not 100% hit rate, but really, really close, as far as I'm concerned. Much better than they're not. And I think that this movie, kind of in a very meta way, mirrors that journey of what it was like as a kid viewer to grow up in the Marvel Cinematic Universe as being your summer movies, being the movies that you would look forward to and you know so well, and you'd be so steeped in that continuity. And that's really mirrored and echoed in, you know, Peter Parker is a kid who's grown up in the world of the Avengers, and now let's see him play in that playground. And I think it's a really fun thing in that way. So unless you've got anything else general, Antonio, I think that we can start breaking into it on a spoiler level. Sounds good?
Sounds great. Let's do it.
So let's swing into Spider-Man. Final warning, if you have not seen the movie yet, you should turn off the podcast along with the dark. Right now.
Spoiler man.
Spoils all the stuff for the young Avengers fans. So what did you think of Spider-Man Homecoming from a story level? This was a fun one, I thought. I really appreciated how it was high stakes but low stakes at the same time.
Yeah, I loved it. I'm shocked because if you look at the amount of writers that are actually credited on this project, I think it's like 6 or 7 names. And usually when you see a film like that, it's going to be a train wreck. You're going to notice the seams on the thing. You're going to say, oh, well, this was the script that Team A wrote, and Team B was brought in because Team A's script did this wrong, and so they foisted this on it, and here's where the reshoots came in. I didn't really see the seams on this one at all. I thought it was really, really great. Not only how, in the Edgar Wright kind of way, which is, you know, his stock and trade, where it's two kind of movies at once. It's a superhero movie, but it's a coming of age teen movie, or it's a high school movie, or it's a John Hughes movie, or whatever you want to call it. And so you've got the high stakes and low stakes things going on there. But I also, my favorite MCU movies are the ones that situate themselves within the MCU such that there are consequences to what's going on with the other MCU movies. It doesn't strike me as likely, for example, and I'm not criticizing Ant-Man because I really like Ant-Man, but the world is blowing up around the world. Like, Sokovia is happening. All these crazy things are happening. And Ant-Man sort of stands alone and is like, oh, here's this character who's going to come into this universe. But like right now, we're just going to tell his story. My thinking is generally it would be miserable to live in the MCU because there are all these horrible things that are happening. Like, you can't go to the Washington Monument. Josh can't take the Staten Island Ferry. You just can't walk around in New York.
Which I do so often anyway.
That's your normal day, right? You take the Staten Island Ferry to the Washington Monument. But no, seriously, like there, you can't go to Coney Island. Like, there are these horrible things. People would hate superheroes or they would have real problems with them. So I liked in Civil War, for example, that we had those stakes. And I absolutely loved that the setup for this movie is the Battle of New York. It's
right,
everything
that,
happened after the Avengers. And that firmly situates this film in the MCU. It talks about how, in a subtle way, those things, these previous movies that are in this, they have consequences. There are people on the ground living normal lives, trying to clean up after these things, and that can change the way they look at the world. And these incidents can create other things. They did that on the street level with Daredevil and Kingpin. I was a huge fan of that, and I love how it was introduced in this film. And then secondarily, Josh, how great was a film by Peter Parker in that regard as well?
Oh, my God. Yeah, getting to see Peter Parker's version of Civil War was a really, really fun and smart idea. Smart in the sense that on the off chance that you did not go and see Civil War, this really summarizes Spider-Man's role in it pretty much and gets you really, really entrenched in where Spider-Man is coming from as this movie begins, where Peter is coming from and what he's just been through. It's a good recap in case you haven't seen Civil War recently before you go into this movie. So, it's now fresh on your mind how all of that played out. But it's also just so, so fun and such a great way to show off Tom Holland as Peter Parker and just like the wide-eyed wonder he displays in every single scene that he's in. Like him seeing his starked up Spider-Man suit for the first time and like seeing it pop up out of the briefcase and being like, oh my God! And then also like him like recapping how he like took Captain America's shield. He's like, hey, what's going on, everybody? Just like everything about it, just like the unbridled enthusiasm and energy from this kid is so fun. And I don't know about you, this was a great movie to see with an audience. There was such a huge laugh as soon as it cuts to a film by Peter Parker. It's just such a spectacular moment and just so, I don't know if subversive is the right word, but certainly unexpected, that I think that the previous two Spider-Man trilogies, or I guess it's not quite a trilogy, it almost was a trilogy in The Amazing Spider-Man's case, but the Sam Raimi Spider-Man and The Amazing Spider-Man movies, they were certainly Raimi's like had moments of levity and goofiness because that's what Sam Raimi trades in, and it's great. But I think that there's also a lot of like kind of a streamlined narrative to both of those films, things that aren't really too outside of the box in that regard. Dr. Octopus tentacle cams notwithstanding. So I think to have this sort of like experimental, playful style as the first thing you're experiencing with Peter Parker in this movie was such a joyful moment. I just loved it. I thought that that was spectacular.
Yeah, the word smart is the right. I just thought it was brilliant. Honestly, it played on all the levels you're talking about. It's a way to say, like, this is our Spider-Man. This is our movie. You've probably seen those other movies. And if you're in this movie and wondering, like, why am I seeing another Spider-Man movie? Why am I seeing the sixth Spider-Man movie, the third iteration of the character in the last, 15 years? Well, this is why. Like, this is why. Because this is their take on it. And it's a take that is fresh. It's wide eyes. It's a different character. And I think that introducing that character in that way, bringing this version of the story forward, and then also doing that by showing his version of the MCU, by showing, as you point out, there are a lot of young MCU fans out there. The same wide eyes that they have are the wide eyes that he has. Seeing the Avengers through Spider-Man's eyes is brilliant because it really situates that character in a certain place, and it allows the film to take off from there. It's an incredibly solid foundation. It's super smart. It's super just connected to the MCU in a way that plays so well. And the pacing is great, right? Because it's a vlog, because it's like this edited movie of everything that he's experienced, it is really well paced. It's joke after joke. It's moment after moment. It's high point after high point. And you get the moments of you get the moments of connection between he and Happy, where Happy is really seemingly not interested too much in talking to him. And that is something that then they trade off as we go forward in the film. So not only does it establish the character and the way that this film is going to take on the character and situate him within the MCU, but it establishes some of the conflict from this film that isn't based on just him chasing Vulture or chasing the way that that's all going to play out, but the conflict of him seeking this approval and seeking to recreate those feelings that he had. And it situates his emotional weight right away from the beginning of the film, and it drives a lot of the decisions that he makes throughout the rest of the film. So I just think it's a really, really smart setup.
Another thing that I think is really great about the movie, just like kind of talking that thread through a little bit more, is it really does trade on the fact that while these aren't things that are necessarily continuity aligned, I don't know if that's the way to describe it, it trades a lot on the idea that you already saw the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies, or you saw the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movies, or you've read 100 Spider-Man comics, or you've seen some Spider-Man cartoons. You know what an Uncle Ben is. Like, you've seen the great power, great responsibility, yada 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 stuff before, and this movie just chooses not to include any of that. None of that is in here. The words Uncle Ben do not appear in this movie. You know, Peter does make a reference to the fact that Aunt May has just been through a lot, but there is no mention of what that a lot is, and both Peter and Aunt May seem like fairly, like, decently okay in their lives at this point. Like, there's nothing, like, you don't sense this big storm cloud that is hanging over the heads of either one of them. And I think that there's probably going to be a contingent of people who watch this movie and be like, but those are essential parts of Spider-Man's origin. How could the Marvel Cinematic Universe's version of this character not include that stuff? And it's like, we already know. Like, we know what that looks like. And maybe we'll get into that stuff again in the future, but we've seen stories that are centered around Peter's darker backstory before. Why not spend some time in the light? Why not spend some time with Peter actually being joyful about being Spider-Man? And that leads to having scenes right away in the movie, like at some of the earliest points in the film, of Peter walking through high school and going about his day in high school and going from class to class and, like, seeing the Betty Brant newscasts in the, you know, playing in the hallways and everything going on with his best buddy Ned and all of that and his crush on Liz. And then it quickly, you know, transfers to an actual Spider-Man sequence, which is, like, very ground level, street level, whimsical, fun Spider-Man. It's not Spider-Man and going out and busting bad guys right away. It's him doing small stuff. It's him, trying to bust, like, small criminals and accidentally webbing car owners to their cars and helping, you know, local neighborhood people, like, find directions to where they're going. Queens can be complicated, Antonio. It doesn't even have to be Canadian Queens to be complicated.
No, but if you help them, they'll give you a churro.
You know, and churros are delightful. You know, you get to see Peter Parker as Spider-Man within, like, the first 20 minutes of the movie, hanging from the side of a building with his mask half up as he's eating food and leaving a voicemail for Tony Stark. Like, there's a lot of business that could be happening here that would make moments like that have to happen at the halfway mark of the movie. And thankfully, Homecoming just yada yadas past all of that and just assumes you know. It would be like a Batman movie, Antonio, starting without mentioning the fact that Batman's parents got killed. What a novelty, idea.
I wanted to bring that up. Aren't you disappointed we did not find out that Spider-Man's mother was named Martha? Aren't you sad that we didn't find that out?
No. I missed opportunity for Michelle at the end of the movie, but, like, actually, my friends call me Martha.
Yeah, right. Martha Jane. But you're right. And the Batman one was something I thought of as well. Like, we don't need to keep going back to that well. Like, we know that story very, very... I know each director wants to tell it their own way. I know each version of the story wants to include it. But we don't have to do that. We don't have to do that to be successful with a character. And I like that he does yada yada. He's like, I was bit by a spider. Well, the spider's dead.
The spider's dead, Ned.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think that extends to a lot of imagery as well, and it allows the movie to create some unique set pieces for a Spider-Man film. As much as this is a great New York movie, and it really, really is, like, there's a lot of fun stuff if you're a New Yorker and it feels authentic, there are a lot of things that are not so New York City-centric. And the first two Spider-Man series that have existed in live action, the Raimi films and the Andrew Garfield era, are really trading in New York. And you see a lot of Spider-Man swinging from building to building flying and crawling up huge skyscrapers and everything like that. This movie can afford to assume that you've seen things like that before and instead put Spider-Man out into the suburbs and like have him, you know, shoot off a web at a golf course. And I was actually kind of surprised that he didn't report back to Ned how far his webs can go.
Good point.
You know, you have him running around the golf course. You have him going from rooftop to rooftop of like, you know, two-story homes, if that. Some of them seemed like one-story homes. So like it was really fun in that way. And you get to put him on a field trip. You get to have Peter Parker in Washington, D.C. You get to see him scaling the Washington Monument. All of that. Those are things that by just accepting that you have seen a lot of Spider-Man in the past, even if it's not necessarily this version of the character, you can do that mental gapping and you can get away with some different sequences that you wouldn't necessarily get away with before, like, you know, Peter trapped inside of the big bunker and getting to try out all of his cool spider gadgets and wearing his, you know, his debate team jacket over his spider suit and just like giving you very natural inroads to what those action figures are going to look like. like very, very, you know, Marvel's very savvy. They're very good at doing sort of like the naturalistic integration of this stuff. So, all of that really, really cool that the film just sort of vaults past a lot of Spider-Man's baggage and converts that stuff into new and exciting ways, both on a story level and also in terms of the visuals and the set pieces.
Exactly. But I wouldn't have minded seeing some bone saw. Josh, can we just get a little bone saw for your boy here? That would have been okay with me.
Bone saw's ready.
Bone saw is ready.
Yeah, that would have been really... you're right.
I got you for 3 minutes. 3 minutes of playtime.
Snap into a Slim Jim. I really like that. I really like that we didn't have to, as you're saying, didn't have to completely revisit all of those the familiar locales, and we didn't get Spider-Man working at a newspaper. We didn't get Spider-Man the photojournalist, but we got Spider-Man using his phone to make a movie right at the beginning of the film. So we're doing similar and slightly different things that could lead into those other things later. So we don't
great
have
emphasis
to have,
on like the science aspect of him as well.
Yeah, because that's a guy, right? He's making his own web material. He's making his own web shooters. Like, this is a Peter Parker who we can actually appreciate for natural skills that aren't superhero skills, that he's just a smart kid, and he's using his intelligence to do that. I think that's a central part of the character that a lot of people love. So watching that be really underscored in this film and putting him in a high school chemistry lab and seeing that, it's a throwaway moment in the film, and it's funny that he's doing it, but it's a good character thing that I think was missing from a lot of previous films because they didn't situate themselves in this way. So you do have all those things. And I think that only not only brings a lot of levity when he's trying to find out if his web is a three iron or a two wood or whatever. But I also think that it really does, as you say, it makes it unique. It makes it feel different and original. And I think that that's something that is difficult to do when you're talking about a universe that's been treading the same grounds for decades. But you've got it differently here. And I think that they make the most of what they're doing. I thought that was, again, it's just really smart throughout the choices that they make and the things they choose to include because of the impact they have on the story and the character as a whole. I thought it was all really pretty seamless, like I said.
And also just to go back to like the suburbia Spider-Man moment, you know, there's the great scene where he's like running from backyard to backyard to backyard. And it's like, you're watching it and you're like, I mean, I certainly was like, oh, Ferris Bueller, this is hysterical. And then immediately it cuts to Ferris Bueller on the TV. So like this is a movie that wears a lot of those influences on its sleeve as well. Like this is a great movie if you're a Spider-Man fan. My good buddy Brett White, who writes for Decider, put together a piece that's it's a slideshow of all of the different characters in the movie and what their comic book connections are, and there were so many that I didn't even come close to catching. So I can only imagine if you're a deep cut Spider-Man fan that this was super, super fun. But also if you're just like a movie fan and if you like those movies from the 80s or you know, these like, you know, angsty teen, you know, these rom-com films, like there's a lot of references to that as well. So John Watts, who's the director, I thought did a really killer job in sort of baking that stuff in. Like even Zendaya as Michelle basically, you know, being like an Ally Sheedy type in The Breakfast Club or Detention there. You know, there's just lots of little touchstones going along throughout the movie as well.
For sure. And the Ferris thing was great. That got a huge pop from the audience when I watched it. And it wasn't lost on anybody that there was that connective tissue, that there's this rebellious young guy who maybe should be in school, but is doing some fun things and really ruling the world in his own little way, instead of doing the things that other high school kids are doing. That, that played really well. The moment with the kids in the tent got a huge laugh. The grilling, I mean, you're right. That was a really fun sequence, seeing Spidey in the suburbs, and not something I'm super familiar with, seeing Spider-Man in that milieu. So it really worked for me. Were they on Long Island, Josh? Is that where they were?
I wonder. I think so. I mean, it would have been that or Westchester. I guess they could have been in Jersey. But I will choose to believe Long Island. That makes sense to me, especially if Spidey lives in Queens and Aunt May can drive them there. Like, I feel like it wouldn't be that far of a stretch to assume Long Island, but I truly don't know.
Imagine if a young Josh Wigler were just camping out in his backyard and Spider-Man ran through. Like, how would that change your world? Like, that
everything
would absolutely
would change. Everything,
yeah, that would be
change.
the craziest thing that ever happened to you. So yeah. I think it's fantastic that they do that. And it's little things like that really put this movie in its own stratosphere within even the MCU, because there are those moments in other movies, but I just, you say a New York movie. I do love those moments. I like when the moment with the ferry, when Spider-Man shows up and the guy's like, yeah, Spider-Man. And then Spidey almost gets the job done, but Iron Man has to come in and save the day. And the guy's like, yeah, Iron Man, it's like, you know, like this
short
is the
attention
world we
spans.
Live in. Yes. This is the world we live in. That rang very accurate to me.
Yeah, that felt true to me as well. Yeah. You know, I was thinking the last time you and I talked Marvel, Antonio, was you and I did a three-pronged movie recap last fall, where we talked about a few different movies that had come out, including Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, as well as Arrival, which was a great movie as well. And we talked about Doctor Strange in that same block. And I think maybe you like Doctor Strange a little bit more than I did, if I'm remembering right. I know that I don't love the movie that much. I think that it's a beautiful movie, and I don't like the cast very much. I thought that it's hard to, you know, even all these months later, like, could you really tell me who the supporting cast of that movie was? Like, could you really tell me who were the standout characters? Maybe Wong, that's basically it. I don't think that you're going to have that problem with Spider-Man Homecoming. This movie is loaded with characters and loaded with incredible actors playing bit roles, like Hannibal Buress just like being the coach, or Martin Starr being the debate coach. You know, all of those little pieces. You know, there's Jacob Batalon, who's playing Ned, who I think is probably going to be the breakout character for a lot of people. Talk about being, you know, a kid in my backyard and Spider-Man swings through, and what would that have done to me as a kid? But you know, I'm the kind of guy who, like, I love me some Chunk, you know, like those are the kid characters who really resonated with me as a pudgy young guy growing up and not seeing like a lot of heroes in my body type. And I can only imagine like who would prefer to be the guy in the chair versus the guy in the suit. And I would raise my hand every day of the week when I was a kid. So to have like a really awesome heroic version of that character in the form of Ned in this movie, like I'm psyched for kids to have that character to look up to and to root for and to love. Cause just as a grown up version of someone who is closer to that than to Spider-Man, I loved seeing that character on my screen.
Yeah, there are so many of those characters that
and
are
like the whole scene of
when he
sees Peter as Spider-Man for the first
right.
time.
Yes.
The whole arcing of that scene is just so brilliant, where the camera is just on Peter and he's very very gingerly getting into the house and making no noise at all, and he's being very intelligent and strategic about how to use his webbing to, like, you know, mute sounds and create little impromptu door stoppers, and he like touches down so softly, and then the camera pans around and Ned has just been watching this entire
yes.
thing
and drops it's the Legos. Yeah, this
so
is
brilliant.
It's really great. Yeah, and he has just Ned throughout, like wearing the hat's not working for me, and doing those things, constantly blurting out, being so excited that his friend is Spider-Man, asking all the questions he's asking throughout. That there's no doubt that if that happened to any of the young versions of us, we'd be very very similar. But I also really like Flash. Like, that is a Flash is always Spider-Man's rival. I know that, and I know that casting Flash is not something that that is always consistent. There are different ways to play that character. I like that it was the lobby boy, Tony Revolori from the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yes.
I really like seeing that guy in this film and just playing Flash around. It's really funny to me that Flash is a huge nerd because they're at a nerd school and he's on the academic team, for crying out loud. So yeah, Flash is a huge nerd, but for whatever reason, he's the alpha nerd over Peter Parker, and he's the one bullying Peter Parker around, even though he's a dude that the vast majority of normal people in society would deem a nerd and would cast out. He, in this realm, is Peter's rival. I really think that that's funny. Maybe they did a little too much, like when he's leaning down the Washington Monument. Do you know Peter Parker? Like, maybe that's a little OTT, but really throughout, I thought that that character also really popped. And you mentioned Zendaya. I think it's fascinating that you're talking about a Disney person, a person who has a musical career, a person who comes into this film with a huge reputation and is playing somebody that's in the background a little bit, that the camera lingers on, and you're wondering, like, what's up with this character? I guess maybe about halfway through, I was like, she's Mary Jane. Like, that's who she is. I know that that's the way this is going to play out, because Mary Jane hasn't been introduced into this movie. We're not going that full route. So this has to be who this is. And I was fine with that payoff, but I really like throughout that she's a different character, and she's getting her own moments. So I thought that that worked really well. And you're right, the cast is just so deep. We can talk about how we've got Donald Glover, the rumored Donald for Spider-Man, the guy whose fans online campaigned for him to be cast as Spider-Man in the past, showing up in this film as a character that I believe has some connections to the comics, but it's yeah. almost like a joke. But then we bring him back for a second scene, and you're like, oh, we've got, there's something going on here.
Yeah, no, that's actually a really cool thing. So this dates back quite a bit, back in the period of time between what would have been Spider-Man 4 with Tobey Maguire and what became Amazing Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield. Once the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies were shut down and a reboot was announced, one of the people that was a very popular fan pick to play Peter Parker was Donald Glover. And that took on some traction with even Donald Glover himself kind of getting involved in the fan campaign. And there's been some great pop culture Easter eggs that were born out of that, like Donald Glover wearing a Spider-Man shirt in an episode of Community. But it led directly, in fact, to the creation of a different Spider-Man character named Miles Morales, who is the Spider-Man of the Ultimate Universe in Marvel Comics, and now is actually part of the Marvel Universe proper. And he is a little black boy from Queens who is 13 years old, who looks a lot like Donald Glover, who is inspired by Donald Glover, as Brian Michael Bendis, the writer who created the character, has said multiple times. And here in this movie, Donald Glover has been cast, who is also, by the way, has lent his voice to Miles Morales in several animated Spider-Man projects. He is playing a character named Aaron Davis, who is Miles Morales' uncle in the comics, and mentions in this movie, I want to see these bad guys get busted because I've got a nephew to take care of. So a pretty, you know, it's beyond a wink and a nod. It's essentially acknowledgement that Miles Morales exists in the Marvel Cinematic Universe as well. So just even chasing that down the line and like forecasting, you know, 8 or 9 years or even less, or even maybe a little bit more from now, when Tom Holland is no longer quite like the youthful Spider-Man that he is right now, like you can envision the second homecoming. Like you can envision the scenario where a young Miles Morales is now getting the mantle of Spider-Man and Tom Holland is playing Tony Stark to this kid. So that's a really, really, really cool thing. And I think that the connective tissue of Donald Glover being the guy who not only brought Miles Morales to life in the first place in the comics very much by his existence and his participation in that campaign, and the fact that he was very inspirational to the comic book creators who came up with Miles, has put his voice to that character in the past as well, and is now here in live action in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, essentially being the ambassador to that character, possibly showing up in the future, is a super, super cool thing.
Yeah, and playing that character, Aaron Davis, in that parking garage, super high. Something was going on there. I was like, what's up with our boy Donald Glover? Like, he's really out of it. So I think it's funny. It's a low-key performance from Donald Glover. But you're right. There's a lot of depth to the character appearing at all. There's a lot of subtext, and I thought that that was really smart. They're doing a lot of things, obviously, setting up possibilities or connections. We had a pretty big actress in Tyne Daly showing up at the beginning of the film, an instantly recognizable face. And I don't know if the MCU is famous for this. Sometimes you could see, for example, a Jeremy Renner pop up in Thor, and with no real introduction, he's just there as an agent who's trying to lock down this site. He's only in the movie for like 5 to 10 minutes, and you're like, what's that Jeremy Renner doing in here? What's he doing in here? Like, this is a big guy. Like, why is he just playing this bit part? But then they play off of that, and they can really introduce these characters that they use later. And sometimes it doesn't always work. Sometimes you get a Glenn Close in Guardians of the Galaxy, who we really haven't seen that bear any real fruit yet. But then sometimes we get a much more brilliant connection, or something that that does bear fruit, like the Jeremy Renner. And I think there's a lot of them in this movie. We had Michael Mando, Better Call Saul and Orphan Black's Michael Mando, showing up, not even speaking in the film proper, just being a guy that's at the arms deal on the Staten Island Ferry. And then he's in the mid-credits scene. He's in the credits roll scene. And you start to realize, wait a minute, like, there is a bigger connection with this guy. Oh, this is going to be something that's going to play out in later films. What's the connection that I don't know the full comic story there. Yeah. What do we have there? What's going on there?
He's playing Mac Gargan, who is the character that is most commonly associated. He's the most commonly associated secret identity for Scorpion, who's a pretty prevalent Spider-Man bad guy. There have been a few different people who have had the Scorpion mantle, and I think actually this movie did some fun stuff with that as well, with Michael Keaton, who we haven't really even talked about yet, so we're going to get into him in a little bit. When he just incinerates Logan Marshall Green, who has been the Shocker.
Your boy.
Your favorite. Yeah, I hope that there's a really, really good music, like OC edit over the obliteration of Logan Marshall Green in this movie at some point.
Talk about fan service for you, just vaporizing that.
I was happy. But it was really cool. It was a great moment because, like, he's been going around as Shocker the whole time, and he looks like Shocker. He's got, like, a jacket that really resembles the Shocker costume, and then he is just incinerated. And our boy, our actual boy, yes, Bokeem Woodbine, who you and I both love, who is Michael Milligan on Fargo season 2 and was spectacular on that season of television and is really great in this movie, he just becomes Shocker. And like, that's like a great comic book trope of like people who would, you know, there would be supervillain aliases or even superheroes who would, their identities, their masks, their costumes, their images, their symbols would pass from, you know, between different parties. You know, we're even talking about Peter Parker and Miles Morales earlier. That's very much a thing that happens with villains a lot. So Mac Gargan is one of many Scorpions, but the Mac Gargan we see in this movie is played by Michael Mando, is showing up here, and it's a strong suggestion of maybe some Sinister Six action in the future, or maybe Scorpion being a bigger bad guy in a future Spider-Man movie. Who really knows? But one of the things that this movie did very well, and while the Vulture is very much the prominent villain in this movie, there were a bunch of other side bad guys as well, like Shocker just kind of being a supporting villain, or Scorpion showing up very, very briefly here, that I think that this ensemble approach to the Rogues Gallery, which is for Spider-Man, is very, very robust. I think second only to Batman in terms of the comic book pantheon of like really memorable villains. To have a bunch of them, to have a few different villains in a movie rather than just doing the Green Goblin thing or just doing like two really pillar villains, but rather taking kind of like a low-key casual approach to the villainy, I think is a really clever thing as well, and I would expect that that's what we would see in a Homecoming sequel.
Yeah, that was smart. And there's concerns about that, too, because characters like Ned have their own comics trace line that you can point from Ned to Hobgoblin, right? So there's a concern, I think, that we could get to a darker point within this universe. I don't think that they'll go there in that way, but it certainly – you introduce a lot of characters that have – in the comics, these stories, whether it's the Donald Glover story like we're talking about, or whether it's something like Ned, there is that. But there are also great connections within the MCU. It was lost on me until I went home and looked it up. I knew that I was picking up on something, but I wasn't sure what it was. Principal Marita at the school is actually connected, right, to Captain America the First Avenger. That's his grandfather.
Yeah, I think
playing the same role. Kenneth Choi playing the same actor.
It's the same actor for sure. And I think I was reading a little bit about the movie today because I got to see it last night, and I've been trying to avoid everything until after I'd seen the movie. So I'm playing some catch up, and I guess there's a photo of Captain America.
That's what I noticed.
Yeah. So the Howling Commandos are in the principal's office. So it's like, oh, well, at least you're like directly acknowledging it.
Yeah, I actually didn't see the Commandos. What I saw was a picture of a Japanese war hero, and I saw a bunch of medals, and I thought, wow, this film, which there are moments throughout where the film is woke. I mean, the whole theme of the movie about them versus us, and we have to try to find ours because all these very, very powerful people will just take it from you. And Michael Keaton's whole backstory is based on a very kind of, what's a woke, the ethos or whatever you're talking about. And there are those moments, like we had MJ basically saying, like, I wouldn't want to go to a monument that slaves built. And Martin Starr's like, no, that didn't happen. And the security guard's like, eh.
Yeah, it kind of happened. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are those moments throughout this film. I was like, wow, this is really woke that they're just taking what is ultimately a background shot and saying, listen, Japanese people fought for our side in World War II and were our heroes as well. Little did I realize that that was actually a direct connection to Captain America. And I knew there was something going on there. So when I looked it up, I was like, yep, there's a lot going on in this film, even in subtle ways and in subtle moments that connect to the MCU, that connect to other comic stories. As I said, this is a film that serves so many masters, and it's just incredible how well they do it. But I also think it's a film, Josh, are we talking about the best MCU villain with Vulture, with Michael, with Toomes? Is it the best MCU villain?
No, I love
Loki. Michael is probably the best.
I love Michael Keaton, but I don't think I could give him that title. Yeah, I think Loki has to be the best, at least for me. I think Tom Hiddleston, like, that was a career defining thing. Like, that was a career launching role, you know, simultaneously with Chris Hemsworth as Thor was Tom Hiddleston as Loki becoming like a name, you know, becoming right. Like a fairly major deal.
Becoming a night manager,
Mr. Night Manager. So I think that he still has to sit at the top of the mountain for me. But I love Michael Keaton as Toomes in this, as Adrian Toomes as the Vulture. And I do think that that's often a problem with the Marvel movies, is their villain game can be surprisingly weak given the
Iron
catalog.
Man 3.
You know, yeah. I mean, look, I really do. I know a lot, it's divisive for people. I love that Mandarin twist, but I think that there's definitely a for the heroes to be as realized and exciting and well cast and dynamic as they are, you can't always say the same thing about the villains. They can often be a lot drier. Michael Keaton was great. And it's kind of a cool capper on the trilogy of Michael Keaton superhero characters, right? Like he was Batman for
literally
a couple of movies.
Birdman.
He was Birdman, you know, which was like the big existential, reflection of his time as Batman in a lot of ways. And now he's through like the other side of the looking glass. Like he's back on the original end, except now he's gone Jack Nicholson's route, and now he's the bad guy. Now he is the Vulture. And he plays it in a really kind of quiet, angry, you know, serious way. He's got some great, you know, one-liners and some, you know, good comedic moments. But he's playing like a real angry blue-collar guy who is like, you know what? You're just like taking me off of projects. Like you're threatening my family and my livelihood. Like I'm going to do whatever I can to protect me and mine. And that's his motivation, rather than I'm going to turn Manhattan into a bunch of like human vulture hybrids. Like with, you know, like the kind of thing that you would have seen in an earlier Spider-Man movie.
Right.
Like the Vulture is definitely doing things here that are not great. And he is selling very, very dangerous weapons and using very dangerous weapons in his crime. And his heists, but really his only agenda is keeping his family afloat and keeping himself afloat and taking the edge where he can. And that's like the kind of volume of villainy that's not really going to register on the Avengers radar, and that keeps him firmly in Spider-Man's world. And I think that that's a great match for Spider-Man, that I think that, you know, before in the Sony movies, when it was just a Sony movie, this is a Sony co-production with Marvel Studios, Spider-Man Homecoming, but when Spider-Man was really existing only in his own universe before, I think that there was a pressure to raise those kinds of stakes.
Right.
To have Green Goblin threatening the destruction of New York, or Doc Octopus having like this huge like nuclear possible bomb thing that was happening in Spider-Man 2. I don't know. It's been a while since I've seen it. Certainly the Lizard was trying to turn everybody into New York into lizard people in The Amazing Spider-Man 1. So,
Strigoi!
You know, Strigoi indeed. So I think that that was very much, you kind of had to, I don't know that you had to go that way, but I think that there was a pressure that must have been felt to kind of raise the stakes of the villainy to that level in those movies. But because that stuff is being accomplished in so many different areas of the Marvel Cinematic Universe anyway, and you kind of have to justify why Spider-Man and his action wouldn't have pinged on the radar of everybody else at this point, I think to keep his villains obviously powerful and dangerous, but to have their agendas and their wants and their desires and their means to be somewhat localized and not begging of the attention of a Tony Stark, I think is a really cool thing as well. So just yeah. in terms of the agenda, in terms of his mission, in terms of what he was after, everything with the Vulture was really cool. And I don't know about you, but I was genuinely floored when he was the guy who answers the door. When Peter goes over to Liz's house to take her to the homecoming dance, and holy crap, the Vulture is her father. And I really didn't see that coming at all.
No, this I know it took us forever to get to this point in the podcast, but I've been so excited to talk to you about this because not just the twist, but just everything about Michael Keaton's role in this film. And you really accurately and fantastically captured how they situated the stakes and how you have Spider-Man on the street level. You have to have a villain who's operating somewhat on the street level, and that's what Michael Keaton's doing. I love that he's got this Walter White story. Call it Vulture White if you want. Call it whatever you want, but he's in it for his family. He started doing this thing because he wanted to help his family. And I think it's brilliant that that is where he starts. But he doesn't end there. Like, he gets to a point where he could have easily bailed from the thing. But I think it's that Walter White thing where he's just like, I kind of like doing it. Like, he shoots your boy. He vaporizes your boy. And then he's like, oh, I thought that was the anti-gravity gun. Oh, well, I'm going to kill Spider-Man, too. Like, it's just this thing that
he broke bad.
He broke bad. He really does break bad. And I love that the genesis of his breaking bad. I was talking to my good friend Andrew Brenner about this, who I see all these movies with, and he's a big comics guy. And we were both really observing that the Battle of New York, in some ways, takes Tony Stark and makes him more of a good guy, if you will, in terms of, I'm going to start buttoning up. I'm going to make Ultron. I'm going to sign the Sokovia Accords. I'm going to deep six all this alien technology. I'm going to put it in deep storage so that it can't get out there and cause harm. I'm going to do these things. I'm going to change the way I operate from outside the system. I'm going to be the one that calls the FBI. I'm going to do these things because of the Battle of New York, because of the consequences of that and the Battle of New York here, and because of Tony Stark being like more of a formalized on paper kind of in the system kind of guy, it absolutely directly creates the Vulture. Like, Tony Stark's hero turn is what creates the villain turn for Michael Keaton's character. It is right at the beginning of the film with Tyne Daly coming in, shutting down the Vulture, by the way, an actual scavenger. I think it's hilarious. Shutting down his operations, him saying like, these guys all have families. Like, I bought all these new trucks for this project. This is a big deal for us. And there is a real world, a real reason for him to do what he's doing. The only complaint I have about that is the twist is great. I mean, in the theater, Josh, where I'm watching this movie, when that happens, there's some lady like maybe four or five rows behind me, and I just hear her. The whole theater hears her. Oh, hell no. Like, she's like very upset by what happened on the screen. And I'm like, that is a good twist. And it definitely traded on the fact that, yeah, we didn't think of her as biracial, that she would have a Caucasian father. Like, that wasn't our immediate thought. That's ingrained in our brains. So they play on that for sure, and they get the most mileage out of that. My minor complaint would be, and I think this is the Walter White aspect of it, and I'm okay with it in that front. I just wish they would have given him a little bit more of a moment of this, is when what happens at the Washington Monument, where his daughter almost dies, is as a direct result of his weapons being on the street. The weapon that's picked up, and Spider-Man and his boy Ned find it, and they take it apart, and then they've got the Chitauri problem coming in there and blowing up. That's all because of Michael Keaton. And whether or not he knows that or not, you would think once the weapons that you're putting out into the world have had a direct impact on the very thing you're saying you're doing this to protect, your family, maybe that's the point where you say, I'm out. I'm not doing this anymore. My shit is causing too much of a problem for the world. My daughter almost died because of me. I'm going to stop doing this. And we don't even really see that moment. He does let Peter skate. He doesn't kill him when he has that the best probably dad driving you to homecoming scene ever, because it is so layered with not only dad driving you to homecoming, but terrifying mass murderer dad, or at least an arch criminal dad driving you to homecoming. That's so good. He does let Peter skate because he saved his daughter. And it's like, well, dude, you're the one who jeopardized your daughter. So I do wish there would have been more of him actually realizing the consequences of his actions. And I think we get that a little bit with the credits roll scene with Michael Mando, where he is, where he's basically unwilling to sell Peter Parker out at that point, because by then Peter has saved his life as well. So maybe there's still hope for him yet. Michael Keaton could play a role in this universe again. I don't know that we're done with the guy. From a legal perspective, Josh, I think he can beat this rap. I don't know evidence. Like, yeah, what do they have? What do they have? A letter from Spider-Man? That is Spidey going to come to court to testify with the suit on? Like, how are they really going to prosecute this guy? Maybe they're going to look into his finances, put a RICO case on him, something like that. I don't know. But I feel like that if the evidence is he was found at a crash site,
missing Chitauri weaponry that fell off a truck, maybe we'll source back to him.
Yeah, or maybe it'll source back to Spider-Man, who went to the most secure location on the Eastern Seaboard and screwed around and laid in a spider hammock and was bored after 37 minutes. Like, there's no cameras in there. We don't see Spider-Man in there. Like, who knows exactly how that will play out? But I think he could still beat the rap. And it's interesting that he's unwilling to sell Peter out at the end. I just think that there was a moment where he could have stopped, and he probably should have stopped if he was really caring about his family. But again, he broke bad. It's the Vulture White. He really did have that Walter White arc where he took it beyond where it needed to go, because I think he liked it.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that to have a scene like that, I do expect would probably tip off the twist a little bit more. I'm trying to remember the chronology of the movie, because clearly I wasn't thinking about it at the time. But is there any moment after the whole mess and mayhem in the Washington Monument and everything with that? Is that where he's basically like, I'm going to find this kid and I'm going to kill him? Like, is that when he's doing that? Because maybe he's just like channeling his anger, and that would be justifiable in terms of like a guy who's not like really taking ownership over his own actions and instead is blaming somebody else. Like, I think that would fit. But I'm struggling to think of where. Yeah. Well, sure. Yeah. I think
it's worth a rewatch, because now that you know the twist, right, it's worth a rewatch to see like if there is a scene like that, because you're right. That would really play well. That would really be a subtle way to show, like, I'm gonna transfer my anger. I'm putting my anger at myself on someone else, because this is my fault, but I'm going to blame Spider-Man.
Yeah.
But he doesn't do that. He saves Spider-Man when he knows. He says in the car, like, oh, you saved my daughter. Like, that's why you're getting a pass here, but we're never going to talk about this again. That's the night he's going to do the one final job. And the consequences of that one final job are he's going to sell a lot of really important tech. And by the way, he's not going to sell it to good people. So he's still on a path where he's going to continue the same actions that jeopardized the daughter that he's thankful that Peter saved in that same night. So that's the only part to me that
he's going to get all that methylamine.
He is going to get all that methylamine. Yes, he's got
a. It's not a train. He's going to rob a stealth jet instead.
Yeah, once you get it, you have to use it, you know? Oh, poor Drew Sharp, man. R.I.P. yeah, deep pull right there, I know. But yeah, that is something where I really liked it. And I like the performance by Michael Keane. What about, we talk about the deep bench. Did you like some of, we talked about Bokeem Woodbine. How about the guy who plays Piper's brother on Orange is the New Black as the Tinkerer?
We didn't get his
official name there. But did you like that character?
Yeah, I thought he was fine. He was just there. There was so much else going on that I didn't really hang my hat on that character too much. I know that the Tinkerer is a background Spider-Man villain as well, but I have very few memories of that character, so it was kind of a little bit whatevs for me.
I think there are ways that they
I like that they had a bunch of different bad guys in this. Like, I've always thought that would be like a clever way to do a Batman movie, and to see that being utilized in a Spider-Man movie where, as said earlier, I think that Spider-Man's rogues gallery is the best in comics, second only to Batman. It's just a really smart utilization of the bench.
Yeah, I'd like to see Batman The Long Halloween as a film. That would be pretty cool.
That'd be great.
I did like the bench and all of these people that were on it. I thought that was great. But I also really liked that in that moment in the car, in the moment later in the warehouse, you've got these – these surrogate father roles with Peter. You have Tony Stark obviously playing that role, and that I think is a very underrated part of the film. The distant father who loves the kid probably on some level, maybe is unwilling or unable to say that in his own way, but is expressing it through his actions occasionally, but is not doing it in a way that the kid feels is good enough. And there, that's the high school movie. That's the trope. You're really trading on that with Tony, but you've also got this this more dangerous dad, like the guy who created from the same incidents, who has been involved in a lot of the same stuff, in Michael Keaton, giving him this fatherly advice and saying, like, you can go the darker route. You don't have to listen to Tony Stark. He doesn't care about you anyway. He's just a rich guy floating around up there in the sky. We're down here on the ground. Like, we need to focus on what we're going to get, because it's always going to be taken from us by the Tony Starks of the world. I just think that there are really interesting kind of dual father figures for Peter in this film. And I think for a lack of Uncle Ben, for a lack of Spider-Man's parent story, I think they find a way to still get a lot of grist out of that with these two characters, for sure.
In terms of the dynamics, yeah. And I really do like that the mid-credits scene, which I think has left a couple of people, probably more than two people, a bunch of people scratching their heads of like, what was the significance of that? Because usually these stingers, and we haven't even talked about the last one, which is maybe the best post-credit scene in Marvel history.
Yes.
There's this moment mid-credits where Matt Gargan is like, let's find, I hear you know who Spider-Man is, let's find him, let's kill him. And then the Vulture like chews on that for a minute and then basically says, if I knew who he was, he'd be dead, don't you think? And I think that that's a very quiet, capper on that character, really giving you this moment of growth for the guy of like, I think once, even like just looking at when Michael Keaton is bound up and is next to all of the wreckage with the note from Spider-Man and his life has been directly saved by Spider-Man at this point, there's just kind of like a resignation to him of like, yeah, you caught me. I mean, I'm not really going to be able to get out of these webs, so clearly you're going to arrest me. And the fact that he's probably thought about the fact that his daughter cared for this kid, was a Spider-Man fan as well, and is now in prison. He's like, now I have an opportunity to get vengeance and kill the kid who landed me behind bars. Like, I think that that's like the post-Breaking Bad moment for this guy of like, no, I did this for me, and I'm not going to take it out on this kid. So I think that that's like a very quiet, subtle moment of growth that you get in the mid-credits scene, and just like a really nice bookend to the Adrian Toomes character.
Yeah, and he sent his family off. We get that off screen with what Liz is saying. Like, he doesn't want us to be here during the trial. We're going to go to Oregon. So there are those character moments, either direct or indirect, that do bring a cap to that character. And I think that that works. But speaking of caps to characters, did you like the use of the Avengers, specifically the Captain America running gag throughout? The rule of three on that was phenomenal.
Oh, it was so great. And again, when Coach Hannibal is like, I'm pretty sure this guy is a war criminal at this point. it was just a really, really funny thing. Like, they're still showing Captain America videos in school, even though Captain America has done what he's done in Civil War. I mean, I guess it makes sense how much money is being poured into education, enough to hire a different Avenger to record all of these different school instructional things. I think you got to stick with the one you've got. I don't think that they have the funds to now go and seek out Thor or Iron Man, or you're certainly not even going to bother with Hawkeye, because who cares?
What's his name? Clint?
Yeah, Clint. Yeah, so I thought that was hysterical. And just like the way Chris Evans would play that stuff was really tremendous, of like how he would sit down in the chair, like backward style, AC Slater style.
Like an adult, like, I'm like you kids. We're cool. Like, hey, fellow students.
Yeah. And then just like the great tradition of like going and seeing one of these movies in the theaters, one of the Marvel Studios movies, just like sitting in the chair and seeing all of the credits and waiting and waiting and waiting and, hashing out what you had just seen with whoever you've seen it with, if you're there with other people, and you're waiting for that final thing. Like, I'm sure it's coming. Let's see what it leads to. And this leads to nothing. It's just Chris Evans showing back up and giving us a PSA about patience.
About exactly what we're doing. About sitting there waiting for something that maybe isn't going to happen. And patience is not always rewarded. And that's an underrated virtue. It's brilliant. It's so funny.
It's really, really great. So the Captain America stuff was terrific. I was surprised about the Iron Man stuff. I really thought, certainly based on the really kind of awkward marketing for for this movie in terms of like the posters were pretty much garbage, I thought, for most of these, most of the posters. There was the one that was just like ruthlessly mocked, at least on the internet, with like, you know, with Iron Man flying in and you see Tony Stark on the side and all of these. It's just such a busy poster. In any case, you think that he's going to be a huge part of the movie. Like, you think that this is going to be like Spider-Man and Iron Man, or like Spider-Man starring in Iron Man 4. And really, it's not that at all, to the point that, like, one of the first times, if not the first time, you see Iron Man in armor, it's not even Tony Stark in the thing. He sent one of the drones. And, you know, you really only have, to my mind, like, maybe 4 or 5 scenes with Tony Stark in them. I thought that was great. You know, I think, again, like you said, I think that there's a really smart way that they're using Tony as kind of a father figure and getting a lot of mileage out of that family dynamic here with Peter without having to go the Uncle Ben route and using Tony in that place, and never having to put him in jeopardy for that matter, and not having him show up at all for the final fight was also really, really cool. So I love the way that the Avengers kind of fueled this movie, but didn't do it in an overly in-your-face kind of way. And I really half expected that through Tony Stark coming into this movie, and I was really surprised with how sparing and wisely he was used. I thought that that was really great. I also loved at the beginning of the movie, one of the first things you see is this Avengers illustration that was obviously drawn by a kid. Do you think that that was a Peter Parker illustration? Is that what we're supposed to think?
I think so, or yeah. I mean, I get the impression that there might have been some level of that for sure. I think there's a Peter Parker connection to Iron Man that they sort of foisted into the MCU.
Well, this has happened this has happened in the press. You know, you get into the junket territory and the world premiere, and so all of these guys are going to start doing tons of interviews going up before the premiere. And there was this this now kind of legendary in these circles anyway, New York film junket, where Tom Holland like told one person in an interview, like, yeah, remember that scene in Iron Man 2 where Iron Man saves a little kid who's got an Iron Man helmet on? He says, you look good in that, kid. That's totally Peter Parker. Peter Parker was already in the MCU, and I talked to Kevin Feige about it. And then like 20 minutes later, he was in another interview. He was like, yeah, I kind of just said it. Like, I don't know if it's really a thing. But like now it's just sort of like accepted as canon, like a retroactive thing that throwaway scene in Iron Man 2 of Iron Man saving this kid in Queens who is wearing like an Iron Man toy mask is Peter Parker. So I love that. I will sign off on that canon. I wouldn't be surprised if one of the movies makes that official at some point down the line, or if it's just something for your own background. But I do think that the movie at least is suggesting that Peter Parker has been, you know, him and Ned are like always geeking out about the Avengers and everything. And you get this impression from that first scene that this illustration of the Avengers is probably by Peter Parker, and I forget the exact line, but something about like maybe that kid has some potential, and Michael Keaton's like, yeah, we'll see. Like, I liked that as kind of like a meta commentary of not just let's see, you know, thematically if Peter Parker has what it takes to be a superhero that stands shoulder to shoulder with these characters, but also like this is a very bold partnership between Disney and Sony in sharing Spider-Man, you know.
Right.
I think that Sony takes the hit on all of the costs involved in making the movie and therefore reaps all of the benefits of the actual money made by the film, where Disney is kind of going that George Lucas route and they're going to make all of the money on the Spider-Man merchandising. I think that that's the way that the arrangement worked out. Maybe speaking out of my ass on that, I'm not entirely sure. I think that that's how it worked out. But it was such an unlikely thing. Nobody ever thought that they would see Spider-Man in an MCU movie. There was no reason to believe that these two major, major powerhouse studios would ever come to an agreement. And so the fact that they did in and of itself was like a shocking thing. And it's kind of like, okay, well, let's see where this goes. It definitely has potential. And I think that there's kind of a meta commentary on that level as well.
Yeah, and it's funny that you find a way to work Star Wars into the universe. Peter Parker with the Star Wars figures and the Legos. And, oh, Star Wars Legos are a thing that superheroes like, kids. Don't you want to buy some more Star Wars Legos or some Doritos? It works out. It works out. I mean, there are going to be a lot of people that make a whole lot of money on this movie, and that's fine. So I don't have any problem when it's good, when it's not just made for that purpose, when it is done in a more subtle way And it is done in a way that, and I don't have kids, so maybe I'd be hating it because I'd be like, why do we have to get, I mean, I saw adults, Josh, walking out of this theater, and I'm not judging them, but they're walking into the theater with Spider-Man, like plastic head, like popcorn bowls that they sold popcorn in that were the plastic head of Spider-Man. And they're walking out of it with like, we observe like, it looked like serial killers walking out with heads in bags. Like,
oh,
what's
God.
Going on here? But yeah, this is a juggernaut and not in the true juggernaut. Not in the Marvel sense, but
sure.
Yeah, this is a marketing juggernaut on so many levels for so many different people, and that's fine because they still did find a way to make it good. And you're right, it is interesting how Iron Man was used to sell this film and the way that sort of played out, considering the way he played out. He's an absentee father a lot of the time, not even present in the world, showing up in the suit. And I do think that that's a great payoff when he's actually there after the Staten Island incident and when he steps out of that suit. I thought that was brilliant. And I thought there was a lot of that paid off on a lot of that concern that had been playing throughout. What about Happy Hogan, though, Josh? Did you get any mileage out of seeing, speaking of people that have made a lot of money off of Marvel movies, Jon Favreau in this movie?
I loved it. I really thought that the Happy Hogan dynamic was fun. It was a low-key, familiar way to tie things.
Low-key.
Not a low-key way, a low-key way to tie things into kind of Marvel history a little bit more. But what I really liked about it is, yeah, Jon Favreau is the guy who directs, you know, two of the first three Marvel movies. He's the guy behind Iron Man and Iron Man 2 and Marvel Studios, Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. And he, you know, is a producer on the Avengers films. And I think that there has been, you know, at least for a time, I think there was a lot of like, well, how involved is he really? Like, is this just like one of those executive producer credits and he's just collecting checks? Or is he actually kind of involved in Marvel still? Or is there some bad blood between him and Marvel given some of the ways that Iron Man reportedly shook out? Doesn't seem to be the case. It seems like he's a real team player and he's really happy to still be a part of the Marvel team. I wouldn't be surprised to see Jon Favreau direct another Marvel movie at some point in his career. But it's really cool to have both him and RDJ, you know, the two original pillars of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, involved in the introduction of Spider-Man to the MCU, to bring who, you know, really is the flagship Marvel character, even though he had not been in any of these new in-continuity movies up until, you know, Civil War a little while ago, and now in his own feature film here. He is the guy. And now that the MCU has that guy, it's really cool to see the guys who brought Iron Man to life and turned Iron Man into the guy. Cause Iron Man was, you know, B-list at best before that movie, really. And now he's a worldwide phenomenon. And so they were really the guys that made that possible. To have them be part of the welcoming committee for Tom Holland as Spider-Man into the MCU, that is really the thing that really, really made me nerd out a bit. And I thought that they did a great job there. And it was cool to see Gwyneth Paltrow show up. I like when they have her as Pepper Potts. I think that they've, you know, there have probably been moments where they've wanted more Pepper Potts. Gwyneth Paltrow is, I don't know, gooping it up somewhere, so she's not always available. But they got,
you know, this is smart because there were so many complaints that they broke up Tony and Pepper off screen because they couldn't get Gwyneth Paltrow for what was it? I guess that was Age of Ultron, maybe. I think it was
Civil War.
It was Civil War, right? So to bring them back together, I think answers a lot of the complaints that people had about dropping that character out of the universe.
And you can do that legwork on your own. You can do that mental gymnastics of like, you know, Tony took her out to like several nice dinners and, you know, rededicated his life to like being a cool dude for Pepper, and she's like, yeah, fine, you're okay.
Well, and it also speaks to what I think the larger story of Tony Stark is, which is that he is, on some level, going a little more straight. I know that Tony Stark, in some of the comic timelines, becomes the Secretary of Defense. Like, he becomes a guy who really is involved in playing ball in an official way and not the rogue superhero who's just going to show up and blow up people's ideas of how things should be handled properly. He's not going to get sideways with the military as much anymore. He isn't going to do the things that Iron Man was known for being brash and being against. He is, as a character within the context of the MCU, evolving and bringing Pepper into the story. I mean, we need more from a female character than just to use her to add characterization to a male character like that. That's what was done a little bit in this film, but it's nice to see her pop up here and play that role and have that play out the way that it did. So I was happy to see her in the universe again as well. And yeah, the Favreau stuff, it's interesting. I was not aware of this. My buddy Andrew, who I was talking about earlier, woke me to this concept that Marvel was having such financial problems at a certain point that they sold off the rights. That's why they didn't own Spider-Man after a time.
Yeah.
They sold off the rights to these characters.
That's why they don't have X-Men and Fantastic Four.
Right. The only reason they made Iron Man, as you point out, he's kind of a B character, is nobody wanted to buy it. Like, that was a property that they weren't able to sell. So that was the first one they really had, besides Hulk, that they could really put their money into. So I think it's fascinating to think about that on some level, that this was the rebirth of Marvel around Iron Man and how let's put it another way. If Favreau comes out and screws up that movie, if it's a stinker, if Iron Man is bad, which I think the original Iron Man is one of the five best MCU films, if it's terrible, do we even have this MCU? Are we 16 films deep if Iron Man was bad?
No.
How much
no.
credit? Jon Favreau should be given so much credit for really kicking this universe off in a way and building the foundation they've built the rest of this stuff on. So it is good to see him back under the embrace of the MCU and to see him in this role. And actually a much bigger character role than I thought it would be in this film. It didn't play as funny to me as I think that they maybe wanted it to. Sometimes it did. The bathroom scene at the end was really, really funny.
Yeah, the bathroom scene with the kids is like taking forever to get out of there, who has clearly just gone dookie. Oh, my God. It's so
funny.
Good.
Very funny. Very fun. Maybe he hasn't. Maybe he's hiding from the creepy older man that is in the bathroom for no reason. Like, maybe that's the only reason he's in the stall. But either way, I thought that was really funny. And I was really glad to see Favreau back in this universe. I thought that they got a lot of mileage out of it in a really good way. What about, Josh, another quick hit that I wanted to bring up with you? What about our boy Michael Giacchino?
Michael Giacchino is great. You know, put that guy in charge of the music for anything, and it's pretty much always going to be great. You know, really, really, what more can I add? Like, a really smart use of the original Spider-Man theme song, a really fun way to bring that in. Just like there was just a lot of the lightness to the movie can be attributed to just like kind of like the bouncy and poppy score that you would hear in the background when, you know, Peter's tinkering around with some of the Chitauri weaponry that he's gotten his hands on in the suburbs, and you know, like the spy mission that he and Ned go on by way of their little like handheld tracking device that they're just chilling out overnight at a sleepover, all of that, really, really great. Like, that's all just being scored so wonderfully. So yeah, Giacchino always is the man, and no exception here in Spider-Man.
Yeah, and what about the running gag with Aunt May? That was really funny, where every man in Queens is like, oh, that's your aunt? Aunt May. Okay, tell me more. Like, I thought that was really funny. At the Thai restaurant, at the sandwich shop, Tony Stark, they're just a lot of people remarking on how attractive Aunt May is.
Yeah, this is a very different Aunt May. This is not the Aunt May that we are used to, I think, in film.
This is not your parents' Aunt May.
Not really, no. But I love Marissa Tomei, and I love the use of Aunt May in this movie, and I'm very excited to see where they take her now. Clearly at the end of the movie, she sees that Peter is Spider-Man, and in every other iteration that I can think of, it's never, at least it's not an easy thing for her to accept whenever she finds out that Peter is Spider-Man, if not something that she outright rejects. I feel like, again, I might be talking completely out of school. I feel like maybe once upon a time, like, she found out in some story that Peter was Spider-Man, and did she have a heart attack and like die from it? I don't really, I feel like that's a thing. Maybe, I'm not entirely sure, but she doesn't love Spider-Man in most of the incarnations of the character. So we'll see what the MCU is going to do with that. I think that could be really fun. They certainly didn't make any kind of meal out of the fact that Aunt May had really any feelings about Spider-Man whatsoever. So it's pretty much a blank slate on that front. A bunch of different Marvel characters, a bunch of different Spider-Man characters that still haven't made their appearance in connection to this version of Spider-Man. Like, still, no one can figure out how to outdo J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson. Like, I feel like it's the hot stove nobody wants to touch, and the MCU so far hasn't done it yet either.
Just bring him back. Just have him play J. Jonah Jameson in the MCU. What's wrong with that?
I mean, he's Commissioner Gordon right now, I guess. Like,
oh, yeah, I guess. Yeah, he's loosely Commissioner Gordon. I guess we can't run that off.
So
yeah.
I guess, you know, it's like a don't cross the streams thing, but I wouldn't mind. I mean, honestly, if they just brought him back as J. Jonah Jameson, I can't imagine anyone would, like, I think that the continuity police could let this one slide. I feel like this is like the jaywalking of continuity obstruction. Like, this is just like the forgivable crime.
Yeah, that guy's always that
the
guy.
The J. Jonah jaywalking.
The J. Jonah Jaywalking is real. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, that I don't know. You're right, because either you can't top him, like you can't even try, or you just let him do it. Just let him do it again. What's the big deal? Like there, I don't know. Yeah. So that would be I think we're a few years away from that. It is interesting that Aunt May has no love lost for Tony Stark. And if she finds out that he's Spider-Man, like where does that go? Another interesting thing I'm curious for you. Tony is basically telling him, be your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Tom Holland, Spidey, has essentially turned down the idea, the role to be in the Avengers. He realizes, I need to grow up a little bit more. I need to live my life, and maybe I'll be your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. If that keeps Spidey at the street level, I know there are connections in the comics. I know they're not really interested in crossing the streams, but why isn't Spidey going to meet Daredevil, Josh? Isn't that a very natural thing to have happen?
Oh, yeah. Very natural thing to have happen in a perfect world, but there is a lot of politics that's involved in the Marvel properties. Like, it's pretty well known at this point that Marvel's, the Marvel Studios characters, the ones that are owned by Disney, are not really going to intersect with the ones that are owned by Fox, and that's the X-Men and the Fantastic Four right now. So that's why you don't see mutants crossing over in the same world as Iron Man and Hulk and Thor and everybody like that. There's never going to be, we'll never say never, because Sony and Marvel decided to cross streams, but it's very unlikely. Yes. And I think that tensions between Disney-owned Marvel and Fox's Marvel stuff, I think that they are that stuff hasn't thawed yet, and I think it'll take a while for that to thaw, maybe eventually, but doesn't seem like anytime soon.
Money is the ultimate disinfectant in that regard. There's money to be made, and if they can put that aside, they'll make it
if they can figure it out. But I think maybe an underreported one is I think that there's actually some friction between the Marvel Studios movies team and the Marvel TV team. I think that they're not exactly the most easy bedfellow. I think that there's corporate conflict involved in that, and I think that's going to make it difficult to see any of the Netflix characters crossing over into the movies and vice versa. Even on like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., it took a lot of arm twisting to get Samuel L. Jackson onto like an episode of that show, and I don't think that they've really done much in the way of bringing big people from the movies into that show. So I don't think that that's something we're going to see. It's something that would certainly make a lot of sense to see. And the thing that would be really, really fun is to bring Vincent D'Onofrio's Kingpin into a Spider-Man movie. That's the one that I would really love to see. But I'm not banking on it. I don't think that we'll go there. I think that the TV shows are going to be their thing and the movies are going to be their own thing.
It's a shame because we don't exist in a compartmentalized world. I mean, we can compartmentalize them theoretically, but from a continuity standpoint, the Battle of New York did happen in the TV shows. Like, these things are taking place. Hydra is in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Like, they take place in the same universe. They have not situated themselves separately. So it's asking a lot, I think, for us to suspend our disbelief for what is ultimately legal reasons. Lawyers are the worst, Josh. That's the long and the short of this story.
I know.
Lawyers are just the worst.
Yeah, I know that you feel that way. One last thing that I would love to get your take on before we start to wrap up here is the Spider-Man suit. Is a lot more spruced up than we've seen in the past. Again, this is one of the clearest ways that this movie reflects the fact that this is a Spider-Man movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that he's basically got an Iron Man suit. You know, it's a Stark-constructed Spider-Man suit that he's using, complete with essentially his own Jarvis, a.k.a. Suit Lady, a.k.a. Karen, a.k.a. Jennifer Connelly, who is voicing this character, who is married in real life to Paul Bettany, a.k.a. The Vision, a.k.a. the original Jarvis. So that's a really fun connection between Karen and Jarvis. So Spider-Man's costume, once it gets off of training wheels mode, I thought that that was pretty spectacular. But the thing that I really like, D'Antonio, is once again kind of taking a superhero trope and flipping it on its head. The thing that you've seen in Spider-Man movies, in fact, but you often will see in a lot of, superhero origin stories or first installments of a superhero franchise, is like you've got that like DIY costume and you're wearing that for like the first quarter or third of the movie. And then you get the super awesome costume and that's your costume for the rest of the movie. And then it's going to get battle damaged at some point, and there's your third action figure or whatever. In this, he started off with a DIY Spider-Man costume that you see a trace amount of in Civil War, and you see him wearing very quickly in the Peter Parker's Home Movies cut. But really, the movie is pretty much right out the gate. It's Spider-Man in full Spider-Man regalia. And the thing that changes is once Tony brings up the whole idea of if you're not, you know, if you're not worthy of the suit, if you can't be important outside of the suit, or whatever it is that he says, his basically his version of great power and great responsibility. And that launches us into the final action, you know, packed act of the movie, where Peter isn't wearing the classic Spider-Man costume. He is wearing his DIY costume. I think that the flip of that arc of like going to just like being a more naturalistic Spider-Man and just being Peter Parker more than being Spider-Man was really, really awesome. And a really cool subversion of that superhero trope.
Yeah, and as you point out, easy way to sell action figures. And you also had the Iron Spider suit, right? Like, we also saw that. So you could sell so many things based on these things. But you're right. I don't have a problem with that if you are finding a way to make that organically appear in the story and actually get mileage out of it, like they did here, as you're pointing out. So I don't have a problem with that at all. And I think it's hilarious thinking about Jennifer Connelly doing that voice. Every kid is going to want a Spider-Man suit that they can put on and have this crazy voice telling them all these things. But I'm thinking there's a large portion of the adult male audience that would love to have a suit they can put on and have Jennifer Connelly squeaking sweet nothings into their ears. Yeah. So it works out on both levels, and it's really smart on that front. Yeah. So, yeah, the DIYer man is really smart. Like, that is I like that. And I like that it's people recognize it. They're like, where's your cool suit? Like, where's your costume? Like, why are you wearing a hoodie? Like, this is so I like those aspects of it. And it is it will be interesting to see what happens with Aunt May in that regard, because if she has no love lost for Tony Stark and he's Spider-Man, she's not going to let him go. Is she going to ground him for being Spider-Man? Like, how is she ever going to get on board with his Spider-Mantics? Like, what's going to happen that really brings her into the story in a way that she approves of? What is a 15-year-old boy putting his life in jeopardy on a day-to-day basis? So I think it's fascinating to put her in that realm. And I think it's a good launch off for where he could easily just say, it's cosplay. Like, I'm just doing cosplay.
Right.
Like, yeah, that's all it is. You know, just a little bit of cosplay. So ultimately, I do think that is something they can. It was a great joke where we end before she finishes her sentence. The audience popped really, really huge in the theater when we saw it. So I'm looking forward to seeing this one again. You're right. Probably something worth seeing in a theater if you are intending to see it at all. And I'm looking forward to seeing it again in a theater, hopefully with a crowded audience, because they're going to get so much mileage out of it. But Josh, there's so many movies coming up and there's so many TV shows to catch up on. I don't know how I'm going to find the time.
You will have to find the time. I'm sure you will find a way to see Spider-Man again. But you're right. There's a lot coming up, a lot that we're going to be talking about here on post-show recaps as well. Certainly Game of Thrones is on the horizon. We are already on the road to Westeros here on post-show recaps. Rob Sesternino and I are dropping preview podcasts ahead of season 7, which premieres on July 16th. And then we will have full court press Game of Thrones coverage for you all season long over there. Fear the Walking Dead is wrapping up, may even be wrapped up by the time you are listening to this podcast. Rob Sesternino and Alex Kidwell will have you there covered with their finale coverage. And then Antonio and I, we are putting our heads together for a few one-off podcasts this summer, catching up on a lot of the shows from earlier this year that we did not have time to podcast before. In some cases, we haven't even watched yet, so we're going to be doing a lot of binge-watching ourselves to get caught up on that. So look out for that in the next week or two. We're going to start launching in to some shows like Legion and Fargo and American Gods. Rumors that we may even discuss The Expanse, Antonio, which is a show that I've really fallen in love with over the past few weeks.
I have heard tell of this. I'm looking forward to checking that out. But I think the first one we're doing is American Gods. Is that right?
I think that's the plan. I believe that is the plan that we're gonna launch off with American Gods. So if you've got questions for any of those shows or more shows, you can send them our way through our feedback form. postshowrecaps.com/feedback is the way to get that done. We would love to hear from you guys. Just make it very clear in your subject line which show you're talking about, leading off with American Gods in just a couple of weeks. So that is the way to get that stuff to us. You can also tweet at Antonio and I. Antonio is at AC Mazzaro. I'm at Round Howard. You got a hashtag for this episode of the podcast, Antonio?
Is J. Jonah jaywalking too long?
It might be, but I like it.
Yeah, I like that. I like Vulture White.
Yeah, I think so that's good. Either one of those. Either one of those will work. Also, in terms of Marvel, we will have some more Marvel coverage for you coming up later this summer when The Defenders drops on Netflix. So stay tuned for some news on that front in the weeks ahead. We're not quite there yet. I believe that's August 18th is when that is dropping. We will have podcast coverage for you that here on Post Show Recaps. Otherwise, any final thoughts on Spider-Man, Antonio?
Spider-Man, my mother's podiatrist, Dr. Spider-Man.
If you're
already fully spoiled on this, I hope you didn't just not see the movie and listen to the podcast. But if you did, I think it's really worth seeing this one in a theater. I don't get any money out of Marvel. Man, I wish I did. But it's a great summer movie. They turned off the dark. They found a way to bring in the light. They found a way to mix in what is ultimately a coming of age high school story with a great kind of street level and larger consequences superhero movie, and found a way to cleverly situate that within the MCU so that there are consequences and it builds on what they've done and launches what they could do in the future. I just think that this is Marvel at the top of their game. And if people feel otherwise, maybe they have different expectations for Spider-Man. I hope this doesn't let anybody down. People that are big fans of the character or have expectations about what a Spider-Man story should be. Because for me, not having those things, I was really, really entertained by this movie.
I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. I can't wait to see where they take the character next. He's obviously going to pop up soon again in the next Avengers movie and the Avengers movie after that. And then there's already a Homecoming sequel that is on the calendar. And I believe that's the only Marvel movie that is officially announced for after the next two Avengers movies. So it's been talked about as the launch pad into the next phase of Marvel. So that's very exciting. Clearly, Marvel has a lot of plans for Spider-Man. Sony has plans for their own Spider-Man universe, but that's too complicated to get into. And really, is any of it really going to happen? I'm not so sure. These cinematic shared universes are hard to put together, Antonio. Just ask Tom Cruise and The Mummy.
Yes, be moved, Josh. Be moved. Be moved to not see The Mummy. Let's not talk about that. Yeah. All right. Okay, my friend, is that it?
I think that's it. All right. So thank you guys for listening to our podcast about Spider-Man Homecoming, and we will talk to you all again very, very soon. Take care, everybody.